Have you been told you don't fit in? The way you live isn't right? You don't look the right way? You don't act the right way? You don't love the right people? You don't believe the right thing? Do you feel the pull of spirituality deep within you and long for a place where you can express it, but keep running into places that want to put you into a box, turn you into another member of their cookie-cutter community where everybody looks the same, everybody lives the same, everybody talks the same, everybody sits in neat little rows, and nobody asks any questions? Welcome. You found a home, because this is the Christ and Light Podcast. And at Christ and Light, we celebrate your diversity. We understand the truth that everybody and everything was created wholly good, absolutely complete and loved, and that each one of us is a bearer of God. Join us now as we discuss the implications of that in our lives, as we explore ways to live out the truth that all of us are Christ events, called to shine forth in the world. Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, whenever you happen to be listening, welcome to the Christ and Light Podcast. I'm your host, Bishop Craig Berglund. I'm awfully glad you've decided to join us, and as Cindy Lauper has just told us, money does, in fact, change everything. And I'd like to talk about money today from a lot of different perspectives, but actually beginning with recent reports of Creflo Dollar's alleged assault of his daughter, his 15-year-old daughter, who had what were called by the arresting officer in his report superficial injuries about her neck. Now, of course, if you know anything about superficial injuries around one's neck, if you have somebody who has been choked, for example, you have soft tissue injuries. Soft tissue injuries don't manifest immediately. Soft tissue issues often manifest as bruising. So if you've ever really whacked some part of your body on something, you may notice that right away there may be a little red mark, but nothing substantial. And then, after some time elapses, after some days, perhaps, or beginning several hours later, bruising, in fact, develops. Bruising, of course, is caused by internal bleeding, broken blood vessels and the like, and more serious events as well. And so it takes a minute, not for the bleeding to occur, but for the blood to do a little bit of pooling and come up to the surface where it's more visible as a bruise. The more serious the injury, or the trauma, the quicker the bruise develops. So the fact that Creflo Dollar's 15-year-old daughter, that's hard to say, had superficial injuries at the time the police were called isn't particularly significant. We can't dismiss out of hand
whatever happened just on the basis of the injuries being characterized initially as superficial. They might be. But that's the opinion and report of a police officer, not medical personnel. And the reason for Creflo Dollar's alleged assault of his 15-year-old daughter is that she was engaging in typical 15-year-old behavior. She wanted, I don't recall the exact details, I could look them up, but they're not that interesting. She, quite frankly, she wanted to go somewhere or do something that he didn't want her to do. And in the world of egomaniacal mega-preachers who preach a kind of obedience that ensures that the faithful will continue to fill their coffers, that simply isn't acceptable. And so allegedly Creflo took it upon himself to ensure his daughter's compliance with the kind of godly message he preaches. The one that says, empty your pockets, empty your wallets, and send them to me because that's what God wants. It is the prosperity gospel, one of, quite honestly, the biggest frauds perpetrated on humanity by the Christian tradition in its history. And it begs a lot of questions. Some of them directly relate to the prosperity gospel. If you don't know, and I've kind of tangentially referred to it here, but not really in a concentrated way, the prosperity gospel essentially says, using the Old Testament verses that have to do with a lot of different things, some of them an understanding that God rewards what we give. Some of them an understanding that we're to give God the first fruits. But there's also, quite honestly, in, for example, the book of Samuel, when the early Hebrew people were considering that they might want a king over them rather than the judges that had been appointed previously to settle disputes. They thought they needed a king. And one of the things that it was said of the king, if they were to get a king, was that they needed to be aware that the king would take the first 10% of everything they harvested. In other words, taxes would follow. Now you and I might say, and by today's standard, 10%, that's not so bad. But to people who weren't used to paying taxes at all, that was pretty significant. No deductions, no loopholes. And then the 10% before that went to God. So you were down 20 before you even started. Anyway, these prosperity gospel preachers tend to take the Old Testament passages about tithing, about tenfold returns, sometimes thousandfold returns, and tell their people that if you send me as the representative of God a contribution, God will give it back to you. Times 10, anywhere from 10 to 1,000. And there's a little, and of course, the more you give, the more faith you show, the faster it will be returned. Now there's a lot of logical problems just to start with from this. Is God an investment banker? Is my first question. If God wants to return what I give, why does it have to be through a particular agent? Isn't God wise enough? Far-seeing enough? To just notice that I'm being generous with my funds, and so reward me that way? Why do prosperity gospel preachers have to be the agents of exchange? And I'm sure, let me just give these people the benefit of the doubt, I'm sure that most of them, when they went into ministry in whatever way they did that initially, most of them had the best concerns of the people they would serve in their hearts. But money changes everything. And so I have to ask, how much is enough? Particularly for people who hold themselves up as ministers of the gospel, how much is enough? Is it enough to have enough to live and live comfortably? Does that seem like a reasonable standard? And if so, why do we have prosperity gospel preachers in this country accumulating tens of thousands? Not even. That's understating the case dramatically. Hundreds of thousands, even millions of dollars in property, automobiles, homes, clothing. Why, when you go into their homes, of course I'm never allowed in their homes, because I'm not part of the club, which is just fine with me. I don't want to be in their homes, because then I'd be compelled to afflict the comfortable. But why, when we see the images from within these homes, why do we see marble fixtures, marble sinks in the multiple bathrooms? Why do we have 8 and 9 and 10 bedrooms, each with its own bath? Why, when you see interviews with preachers, not necessarily prosperity gospel preachers, but preachers out of this mega church. I'm not talking about your local mega church. I'm talking about people who have ministries that reach internationally. Why is the measure of how well they're doing in their ministry the amount of stuff they have, the splendor of their home? I mean, okay, live in a $1 million home. Drive a really nice car. Furnish your home well. Make sure your children's needs are anticipated and met. Absolutely on the last. But then where does the line get drawn where the preacher preaching this kind of nonsense starts to impose those same rules upon themselves? You know, it's great to talk about sacrificial giving. But if you're not participating in sacrificial giving yourself, preaching it just becomes another form of hypocrisy. These worldwide preachers with worldwide influence, and that influence, by the way, is slipping away. It is waning at a frantic pace, I believe, to a large part due to these kinds of behaviors that people are getting wise to. But why? Aren't they willing to, say, release a financial statement like any other charity that reflects how much of their received contributions are being used up in staff over and other overhead? Does a preacher really need 400 people on staff? Or is that really then just another brand of corporate religion? It becomes like corporate farming. Big business. It becomes less about the message and transforming people's lives and more about the bottom line. And expanding throughout the world becomes a kind of imperialism. And it's all a tremendous ego fest. Look at me, I'm a rock star. Okay, good for you. Go be a rock star. And have the honesty to call yourself a rock star. And then I have no problem with it. Rock star preacher. Very cool. If that's your gig, God love you. But please don't stand there and present yourself to the world as somebody who's interested in helping others, because you're not. In no sense of the word help are you at all interested in helping anybody but yourself in any way but in your pocketbook and your bank account. And you're doing it on a tax-free basis because your particular corporation claims to be a church. Help me, somebody. Help me understand how exactly that works, because I would love to know. Now, here's another component of this. I once knew a guy, I knew him once removed. I knew somebody who knew him. And all of a sudden, this guy shows up on the 5 o'clock news. As part of a sting investigation by one of the local network news stations. And he was selling financial products to the elderly. But they weren't really sound financial products. They were attempts to defraud the elderly. To bilk them out of their savings in hopes of a substantial return. And while he wasn't prosecuted for this, there was no doubt that it was bordering on the criminal and at the very least highly unethical. What I'd like to know is, how is that different than encouraging people to send you substantial amounts of money and promising a return that isn't going to happen? Or that if it does happen, it's going to happen for only a very small percentage of the people who send you the money. And what's more, let's be clear, the people most likely to send you money in this kind of a desperation play are the less educated, and those who can least afford it. Now, those two things may go hand in hand to one extent or another, but if I'm worried about, say, just living on the little bit I've been able to save and my Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, if I'm close to or at retirement age, or even beyond retirement age, and I'm noticing my money isn't going as far as I had hoped it would, and I'm a person of faith, so I've been exposed to preachers and pastors and all those kind, even of this sort, this prosperity gospel sort, and I say, you know what? I need more money. I know I'm a person of faith. And this pastor says, if you're a person of faith and you send him money, God's going to bless it. And while to those of us who were not raised in that particular religious culture of prosperity, that might seem pretty much of a reach, it doesn't if you were raised within there. And then these people send their money, and they're no different than the man I just told you about who was caught in a local TV sting operation selling shoddy financial packages to people, to the elderly. And yet we have a the ultimate shelter, if you will, for people who engage in this kind of behavior, supposedly, not really in the non-establishment clause of the Constitution, but that's always the claim. The Constitution says we have freedom of religion. And a lot of things are foisted upon people in the name of freedom of religion. I just love how the Catholic Church, for example, right now is trying to hold up freedom of religion as meaning that they can impose their own religious views on whoever they darn well please, and so in fact impair the religious freedoms of the people they're trying to oppose them on under the guise of religious freedom. It's nonsense. And it's not even sound thinking. That, too, is just the same kind of manipulation that the prosperity gospel engages in. And there's all these standard defenses, you know, that a gentleman accosted me on Facebook about the link I posed to Creflo Dollar and asked, when are we going to see that the prosperity gospel is nothing but a sham? And he, of course, coming out of a tradition similar to that, decided to take umbrage with that. To say Jesus was rich, and well, I grant you that there's some research that indicates that not unlike today, a carpenter, a tradesperson in the day, could make a subsistence living or a little better. You can't very well say that once Jesus becomes an itinerant preacher, he was building a whole lot of things. He himself said that he had nowhere to lay his head. But you see, these prosperity preachers have also convinced people that Jesus was financially rich. Now, I would say Jesus was spiritually rich beyond measure. But it's always curious to me how the wealthy want to cast Jesus as wealthy. But of course, continuing to preach the prosperity message will only work if we convince people that it worked for him. Money changes everything. We all know people who have made it big, if you will. We knew them back when they were just fill in the blank, and now they've made it big. And often as not, we talk about how those people have changed. How they aren't the people we knew back in the day. Well, money changes everything. And so the gentleman who wanted to take umbrage with me about the prosperity gospel had assumed, because we've been together at different functions, that I too am a high roller. By being there, I must be, right? And he challenged me on that, and so I laid it out for him. I'm not a high roller. Then I was bitter. Systems of belief that have an explanation for everything. Systems of belief that cannot tolerate a difference of opinion. And most especially about the particular belief. You know, someone who's saying, this works like this, all the time. And somebody says, you know, that really wasn't my experience with it. It didn't work this way for me. Well, now you're bitter or didn't apply the principles correctly or any of a number of other nonsensical explanations should always arouse suspicion. It's no different than going to a car dealer. Suppose you buy a car and you drive it down the street and something just isn't right. It's not handling the way it should, it's a little wobbly, whatever the issue is. If you went back to the dealer and said, you know, I think there's something wrong here. And the dealer said to you, you know, you're just not driving it right. I don't think you'd be willing to accept that explanation. You know, you hit 60 miles an hour and the wheels come flying off. And they tell you, well, don't drive it over 60. That's not going to be an explanation you're going to buy or be satisfied with. It's been said that love of money is the root of all evil. And I think there's a great deal of truth to that. Because love of money implies attachment to money. Now, we all want to have enough to eat. We want to have food, we want to have clothing, we want to have shelter, we want to have a little extra money to be able to do the things we like. We even want to live comfortably. And there's nothing wrong with any of that. But what gets in the way of spiritual growth is when we start saying, I must have these things to be spiritual, healthy, whole, happy. We get onto some very dangerous ground because, in fact, things go away. Whether your things are investments and the economy tanks, or your things are that brand new car and it gets its first ding, or a particular ministry, or a particular job, or your health, it all goes away. In fact, aging is about a process of letting go of one thing after the other, which makes it an intensely spiritual practice. But the problem is that the prosperity gospel mavens have set their people up to believe that having more and more is a sign of spiritual growth. So what does it mean, then, as you age and have less? For that matter, what does it mean after the prosperity preacher cleans you out and tells you that it's your fault because you simply didn't have enough faith? These are the problems. These are the issues. This is what has happened to destroy the credibility of spirituality in the West. Can we hold the things we have loosely? I certainly have things I like, things I'm attached to. But I work on decreasing those attachments all the time. And are these things in question helpful to me or hindrances to me? If they go away, and they will all go away, Will I be able to believe that I continue to exist, or somehow will the best part of me be gone? I think I've told the story before about a gentleman who I read about. I think he was in the Washington, D.C. area, but I could be way off base on that, could have been New York. It was a big city. And he had been an executive, a high-level executive. And corporate downsizing caused his position to be eliminated. And so, as he sought a new position and was having trouble finding one in the economy at the time, he decided that the only way to maintain his sanity and feel like he was really trying to do something would be to dress up every morning in his suit and go to the local Starbucks and go online and look for jobs there. And he would at least feel as if he was going to the office, and he recognized that that had become an important ritual in his life. And there's nothing wrong with that, and I think he was astute to recognize that. And so he would go to Starbucks and, you know, go online and search for jobs, and he'd be there every day, and the staff came to know him and started having conversations with him, and he told them his story, and he had been out of work for some time now, and his savings were dwindling, and staff at Starbucks told him, well, they were hiring. And so recognizing in himself a need to be busy, a need to work, he took the job. And reported afterwards that he'd never been happier in his life. He said, sure, I don't have the things I once had. I don't have the belongings I once have. I live much more modestly. But I'm not paying the price of the stress of the lifestyle I used to lead, of the work environment I used to function in. I can actually enjoy being alive. Which I think is a pretty telling indictment. That the kind of success he had enjoyed came at the price of being able to enjoy life. And what is really worth that? And I can't help but wonder then, if some of these folks in that prosperity culture aren't stuck in that same place. The stress, the go, go, go. The running all the time. The getting to the place where you need to raise millions of dollars a month just to keep your operation afloat. And I ask you, is that spirituality? Is that religion? Sounds very much like the corporate man who ended up working at Starbucks. Sounds very much like his existence was. The existence he recognized was killing him. And I'm sure a lot of the problem becomes saving face. You know, if you've spent all these years telling everybody that financial gain is a reliable sign of God's favor, and you then decide you're going to abandon the pulpit and work at the Starbucks, people are going to call you on that. But you know what? Who cares? Are we going to base our spiritual journey and our life's journey on the opinions of others? Or are we going to base our spiritual journey and our life journey on what's life-giving, what brings us to wholeness? What makes us happy beyond the ability of situations and circumstances, the changes and chances of life, to destroy our happiness? I don't know how a person can be happy. Maybe they can be. Preaching the prosperity gospel and developing corporate religion, really, to the point where there's no choice but to always be on the go, to always be chasing, to always be racing, to always be worrying about where the next dollar is coming from. As I've said in other contexts, Jim Baker, just before PTL collapsed, had to raise, I think it was $1 million a day just to stay afloat. It's the kind of pressure I can't imagine, and I would suggest that the prosperity people are now in that same boat, but in a culture where people are turning away from religion, ironically, at least in part because of the prosperity mentality. Not completely, but in part. So your pool for fundraising is shrinking, but your need for the money because of infrastructure hasn't changed. I can't fathom that kind of pressure. And I can't help but believe that if anybody involved in it who wasn't criminally pathological slowed down long enough to look at it, and honestly assess themselves and their impact on people, I can't help but believe that they would be miserable. In some instances, probably suicidal. Jesus said it's easier for a rich man, it's easier for a camel, or in some translations, a rope. Some people believe rope would be a better translation, but it still works. Easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle, and for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. It's not an endorsement of wealth, or a critique of wealth, rather. It's a statement that our attachments create, if you will, ginormous saddlebags that make the eye of that needle even tighter than it was in the first place. So can we have our money and can we hold it loosely? Determine a point at which enough is enough and then take time to enjoy life rather than continue to accumulate more and more. Can we abandon outmoded and outdated pictures and views and perspectives on God that suggest God is some kind of a banker or a financial trader just waiting for us to ask in the right way, say the right prayer, make 3 rotations clockwise, 2 rotations counterclockwise, and then do 6 jumping jacks and then the reward will come? Can we start to see that unlike human beings, God is a lover of all people equally? Unconditional love is about there not being any favorites. And if we can start to get in touch with that reality, that view that really transcends spiritual tradition, these people who come along and want to play us for profit will have a much harder time doing so. Because we'll know that's not of God. Until next time, I'm Bishop Craig Berglund. I wish you God's rich blessings. Namaste. We thank you for joining us for this Christ and Light program. We're glad you decided to join us. Christ and Light offers a variety of programming and teachings available throughout the week. The Christ and Light podcast uploads weekly, usually on Monday mornings, and discusses a contemporary spiritual issue or teaching from a Christ and Light perspective. Christ and Light has a program on Blog Talk Radio on Wednesday mornings and Sunday mornings at 11 Eastern, 10 Central, 9 Mountain, and 8 Pacific. On Wednesdays, our program looks at spiritual issues with a sense of humor, even when those issues are extremely serious. On Sunday mornings, we offer a weekly Sunday morning message based on a Christ and Light interpretation of the Revised Common Lectionary Scripture readings for that day. All of our internet programming is available at no cost to you. To learn more, visit our ChristandLight.org website or access the podcast and the Blog Talk Radio program at no charge to you on iTunes. We also write an engaged spirituality blog, which is available on the ChristandLight.org website. We blog Monday through Friday, and also on each morning, we upload a spiritual teaching for the day 7 days a week. There is a Christ and Light gathering in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. To learn more about that gathering, visit the Christ and Light website. This program is copyright 2011 and 2012 by the Ecumenical Franciscans of the Renewal. All rights are reserved. For permission to reprint or use audio from this program, please write ChristandLight@gmail.com. We thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Bishop Craig Berglund. I wish you God's rich blessings. Namaste.